Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne. Redbeard, you don't have to keep defending me. We need Perry Mason. When I'm writing songs, I always kind of, whatever kind of the mood of the song reminds me of, I'll put like a working title, you know, like, and what it reminds me of. And the rhythm of the track reminded me of like a detective thing. And I saw Perry Mason, you know. So as a reference to go back to, I'd say, let's go back to that Perry Mason track. And it kind of accidentally happened, you know. It was I didn't consciously sit down and go, yeah, let's write a song about Perry Mason because he's been on the TV for as long as I can remember. And lo and behold, as soon as we finished writing the song, he died. And I thought, oh my God, I better stop writing songs about people that are all going to die, you know. Well, if people take me too damn serious, it's like, I mean, I have sang songs about the darker forces, but I've also written songs about everything across the spectrum, from pollution to politics to war to poverty to happiness to a boy meets girl, you know. And it's just that people go, oh, Izzy Osbourne, he bites the heads off things, or he pisses up the Alamo and all this, you know. I kind of feel like typecast. I feel like the guy that acts Superman, that he's a great actor, that he wants to do another role as a doctor, but any time now you expect him to take his gloves and his face mask off and fly out the window with an S on his chest, you know. And it's kind of what I've desperately tried to get across is that if you think that you know Ozzy Osbourne, you ain't even touching the surface, because I don't even know Ozzy Osbourne, because I so often frequently surprise me, you know. And with all the years that I've been doing what I've been doing, I mean, I get a kick out of surprising me as much as anybody else, you know, because I think, well, every time I go, I can't do it anymore. I've got to, eventually, the well's got to run dry, and I've got to dry up, but it comes on, man. I wouldn't say I was serious. I would say I was dumb. I have like what we call in the family wobblers. I get like pissed off with it, if I can use the word. I have a pissed off day, and I said well, one day, you know, that's it. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm sick and tired of being on the road. I'm sick of going to the doctors. My voice is never right. It's never right. All the time I'm selling loads of records. The gigs are filled up. No one's really complaining, but I am, you know. And Sharon said, "You want to retire?" I said, "That's it. I've done it. I've achieved everything that I want to achieve. I want out. I want to know what it's like to be a regular guy." So I learned one big thing. Don't ask for too much, because sometimes you'll get it, you know. And then when I thought, when I'd calmed down, I thought, what have you done, you know? And then I went home and I allowed myself like time, and it was fun for a while. I mean, I didn't have any commitments, and it was kind of fun. But then you only know what you've had when it's gone, you know. And here I was in my little house in England, and I bought my toys, my motorbikes, and my cars, and my whatever, and then I've got this weird habit of, when I get antsy, I sit in the kitchen and I keep standing up, opening the refrigerator door, closing it, sit back down, open the refrigerator door, close it, sit back down. And my wife said to me one day, "What's wrong?" I go, "I feel like a fish out of water." And she said, "Well, I only do what you tell me to do. You told me you wanted to disband. I've disbanded. Now, what do you want to do now?" I said, "Well, me without a band is like I'm walking around naked, you know." And so she said, "Well," she went, "Oh, here we go again, you're welcome." And so I'd met Michael Beinhorn. I first started working with Steve Vai. That didn't really work out. Not for any other reason that the record company didn't feel that it was they pulled the shots, and I just didn't feel that it was a good idea. So, oh, he's a wonderful guy. what is a sweet guy, and I have nothing but the highest regards for him. I have nothing but the highest esteem for him. I mean, when we were writing, the reason why we didn't get too much finished was the fact that I was so into watching him play his instrument. I was forgetting what I was there for, you know. The guy plays like he reminds me of a butterfly when he plays. It's like poetry in motion, you know. The guy, I cannot speak highly enough of him. He treated me and my family. I mean, he's just a great guy. I mean, he's wonderful. I mean, maybe one day up the road, it's not an impossible thing that I'll get together and do something with him. In actual fact, one of the songs that we did write together, one of the songs made the album called My Little Man.
Thank you.
because the you know the album debuted at number four this week. I was absolutely stunned. I was in shock. I didn't sleep all night. It's really weird. I did the show on Halloween night. I messed my back up. I went round to the hospital and I'd got like a muscle spasm in my back. So I go back to the hotel and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't get a comfortable position all night. But there was like this weird. I didn't know what day it was. I don't know what month we're in. I'm clueless. All I know it was Halloween the other night, whatever month that's in. So I phoned up my wife at 7 o'clock my time in the morning because I just couldn't sleep. I was in so much pain in my back. And she says, my secretary who lives at my house, I got an office at my house. She said to me, Sharon needs to talk to you urgently. And I thought, what's going on? The kids, something's happened to the kids. I said, Kathy, what is it? Tell me, what's the problem? She's gone, well, I can't tell you. I said, Kathy, don't play mind games with me, man. I'm freaking out. Is it the kids? Is it my mother? Is something happening? She goes, look, is the number of the car? Phone Sharon. She's waiting for you to call. Because I put a block on my calls in my hotel because I get every crank finds my alias name and phones me up. So eventually, I phone her up and she goes, well, I've got something for you. And I said, don't screw me around, Sharon. I'm like vibrating in the bed. And she goes, well, you're going in at number four. I said, what do you mean? And she goes, in the Billboard charts. And I go, there was like a gasp. And then I wanted to phone everybody, but everybody was asleep. My poor assistant, Tony, had left me at 6 in the morning. He just got to bed, and I go, Tone! He goes, And I go, Tone, we're at number four! And he goes, what? Then he wakes up, he can't sleep. I don't sleep, and we both got here last night like two drowned rats, emotionally wrecked. Went to bed and died for about 12 hours, you know. I mean, that let me tell you something, that is the highest entry I've ever had.
There no one like a loss. There no one winnable wars. There no one rightable wrongs or unsinkable song. There no unbeatable odds. There no believable gods. There no unnameable names. Shall I say it again? Yeah. I just want you. I just want you. There are no uncriminal crimes. There are no unrunnable rhymes. There are no
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Ozzy Osbourne with Redbeard. Now, well, what happened was I met Michael Beinhorn, and Michael Beinhorn said to me, let me tell you the whole shit, the whole stick. Well, right, and on No More Tears tour, on No More Tours tour, whatever we're calling, what that mistake, right? In the middle of the tour, the record company said to me, well, we want to do a live album of the tour before you break, you know, for when you break up, blah, blah, blah. That was Live and Loud. But what we need is a couple of extra tracks. We have a great idea, and we know you've been killing yourself on the road, Ozzy, for the last year, but you got like 3 weeks off coming up. Would you like to have a nice little trip to Vancouver and write us some songs for the extra tracks for the album? So I go, okay. So we all go to Vancouver. We start writing. We wrote Perry Mason. We wrote Tomorrow. We wrote a bunch of stuff. See You on the Other Side. We come back and they hear them. They go, wow, that's great. Why don't you? While you're on a roll? Now the wheels are starting turning now. And I'm going, I've been hoodwinked again here. Why don't you see if you can get another album out of these guys? So I'm going, well, you only asked me for two or three tracks for this live album. Ah, but we're going to record the Black Sabbath reunion thing on the last show, and then we'll be the extra tracks for the album. Blah, blah, blah. So to cut a long story short, I'm off the road. I go straight into the studio to try and complete an album. So I recorded an album, and I knew in my heart of hearts that it wasn't a great recording. So what I did was when I met Michael Beinhorn, I gave him all what I'd done, and he said, that's no good, that's no good, that's good, that's we can work with that. And he filtered out what we could work with and what we couldn't. So out of an album, I was reduced to about four, maybe five songs. So then I said to him, well, Zach's got Pride and Glory, Mike's with Alice in Chains, and I don't know what Randy Casillo's doing. I mean, I think he had a band called Red Square Black at that point. And he said, Michael said to me, have you ever tried working with songwriters? And I said, well, no, not really. And I was kind of offended by that at first because I thought, well, I have these like weird pictures in my head, like that I sit in a room, sit on a chair, and there's a guy there with a piano and says to me, Ozzy, now I want you to sing this. You know, he writes a song and like talks to me like I'm a dummy, and my ego got in the way, and I said, like, screw that, man. So anyway, to cut a long story short, yet again, I said, okay, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So this is after the Steve Vai episode. So I'd written a song with some stuff with Steve Vai. He picked My Little Man up the Steve Vai thing. And then I met Jim Valance, who wrote a lot of stuff with Bryan Adams, Mark Hudson, Steve Dudas, who'd written a lot of stuff with Aerosmith, Taylor Rhodes, and a whole bunch of writers. And one of the most amazing things that came out of that, which was really, really an eye-opener, was I thought that I was just going to be sitting like an idiot on a chair and they were going to sing songs to me. But it was great because my street-level way of doing things is a great breakthrough for them because they have convention where I have no convention. In other words, they have a formula. They have a kind of like Desmond Childs, you know, like Desmond Childs had Living on a Prayer. Then he had like Poison, and then there was another eight different versions of Living on a Prayer, but with a different title. So what I did was demolish their barriers, you know, their safe barriers, and the outcome of it was that I mean, they were like, wow, man, I never thought of that, you know. Why didn't I think of that before? And I remember one incident when I was in Vancouver with Jim Valance. And Jim Valance is a great, lovely, I love him, right? They all were great guys to work with, every one of them. And I'm in the studio working, I wrote about four or five, there's so many songs left over, by the way, that the follow-up to Osmosis will nowhere near be as long as 3 years. I could do an album tomorrow, you know. I've got stacks of songs. I've got songs. There was another song called I've Fallen Up, But I Got Back Down. Rasputin. I Can't Walk on Water. I Did It All Because of You. Back on Earth. shit, loads of stuff. So anyway, Jim Valenci's studio in Vancouver one day, and his wife, who's a very conservative, very lovely woman, comes in the studio. She comes up to me and starts crying. And I go, what's the matter with you? I said, have I done something wrong? She says, no way, man. I said, well, what do you mean? Oh, now I'm confused. I'm thinking, what's going on here? She said, I heard the stuff you've been writing with Jim. I said, well, what do you think? And she says, what do I think? I said, yeah. She said, I Just Want You is amazing. I said, well, yeah. I wrote a song called I Just Want You. I Can't Walk on Water. And All Because of You. And a couple of other things. And I said, well, why are you crying? She said, well, he had such a bad experience 3 years ago with one of the bands or something. He came home. Because he's got his own recording studio, she said he came home, threw the keys on the table, and he says, that's it, I'm going to live off the studio, I'm not doing any more writing, it's not worth it. And she said, what you've done for him is, therapy wouldn't do it, whatever. She said, you brought the Jim that I used to know back, and that was great, you know. I mean, he's a nothing short of a gentleman. And Mark Hudson, I mean, we had such a laugh, Mark Hudson. Me and him and his partner, Steve Dudas, we wrote, like, some days, I mean, on some days, we would write, like, five songs, you know. I mean, the essence of what I'm saying is the difference between writing with a band, per se, as professional writers is the fact that every day that I would go in, I would come home with a song. Not necessarily saying it would be a smash song, but some were hokey. But every day I would come home with something. Whereas when I was with a band or with the Steve Vai situation, the record company flies in. And I go, okay, you've been here for 3 months, Ozzy. Play us what you got. And you play them two songs, but you got like another 10 songs which you haven't completed. I would complete a song, you know. At least one, maybe sometimes. One. I remember with Steve and Steve Dudas and Mark Hudson, we just locked ourselves in this demo studio. And I remember him saying, it was like this grotty, it was quite funny actually. I should have videoed it, you know. It's this ancient ADAT machine, this thing. It wasn't even an ADAT. It was an old recording thing with carpet on the walls just deadening the sound. And Mark Hudson, if you ever meet him, he's the funniest guy you've ever met in your life. Because Michael Bynon was flying into London, and he said to him, Michael Bynon's coming to London, we've got to play him some stuff. He said, if you want to go to the bathroom, you do it there. If you want to eat, you do it there. If you want to die, you do it there. But you're going to... I had to leave the studio. I was doubled up laughing. I was dying. And it was like being in a sweat box. You know that film Bridge Over the River Kwai when they put that Alec Guinness in that box? It was kind of like that. But it was a lot of fun. We had a laugh along the way. But getting back to the album, now it comes to doing the album. I've got all these songs. Michael Bynon picked what he thought would make the album. I hadn't got a guitar player, so I said to Zach, look, would you help me out and just play on the album? I said, I know you got to do it. He says, sure. So rather than get like Steve Vai to play My Little Man, which he wrote, and then different guys to play, I didn't want to make an Ozzy Osbourne all-star record. So he very kindly came along and did the whole album. And then he's got, to be honest with you, I don't know where he is now. I don't know what he's doing. But I wanted to get the same kind of like guitar player all the way through. Now, the drummer, Dean Castanova, on the album, didn't work out on the stage. The chemistry on live gigs just wasn't right. I mean, I love the guy as a guy, but it just didn't work on a live basis. I mean, in the studio, the man is phenomenal. The man is a brilliant, brilliant drummer, and I'm not going to sit here and put the guy down because he is a fantastic drummer. It's just like the way I look at it. And I said to him when we separated, I said, listen, man, Ringo Starr was not a great drummer. But for the Beatles, the chemistry was great. That's what I'm trying to say. you know, I keep thinking to myself, well, you know, I don't think this is as good as that, and that's not as good as this, and you could have done better. I'm always working on the album, even the old records, you know, Diary and Blizzard and so on. I always, you know, when I listen to them, I go like, I should have put a backward gong there, I should have put this on there, I should have put a, whatever. But that's all, I suffer from terminal perfectionism. And I mean, when I'm making a record, I'm not a very pleasant human being to be around. In fact, I'm quite a bad guy. I'm like, it's like, don't touch my music. Don't tell me about my music. Don't say anything to me because I'll, you know. And I go, what do you think? I go, you want to hear what they've done to this record? It sounds terrible. Play it to somebody. Listen to that. And I go, wow, man, that's great. And I go, you think it's great? I'm the guy that buys a record and looks for the hole, the mistake, you know? Instead of just sitting back and enjoying the record, you know, I go, ah, yeah, I can see what they've done there. They flick that. I mean, you know, I dissect. I should be I think in my last life I was a coroner or something, you know. Now, listen, I'll tell you something. Have you got my record file near you? Can you do me a favor right now? Do you have the record Sabbath Bloody Sabbath? When you find Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, look under the credits for Sabra Cadabra, and you will see the name Rick Wakeman.
See, I'm always full of surprises.
Yeah, in the old days, we used to record at a place called Morgan Studios, which is no longer existing, and it's... I mean, everybody from Rod Stewart, everybody you could, the T-Rex, everybody recorded there. Everybody. And, the studio was always full of, like, mega stars. It was like, there was, like, Sabbath, Yes, Rod Stewart, Lou Reed, Jethro Tull. The list's endless. It was never, and they used to have a bar there. And it was like, it was just incredible. I mean, if they wanted to wipe out history, rock and roll history, then they should have, and they blowed that studio up. It would have, I remember one time there was people like Paul McCartney. I mean, everybody was in this bar one day, and it was like, I was going, fucking hell, man. It's like the Hall of Fame alive, you know. And so what happened was, Rick was doing the Fragile album with Yes. Now, they were all into the brown rice and the jar sticks and all that, and cut out cows in the studios and whatnot. And Rick was just like, me, a pirate, and me and him would be in the bar getting drunk, throwing darts at a dartboard all night long, you know. And I mean, Rick and I go back many, many, many years. It's not just, I just go, oh, Rick Wakeman. Rick Wakeman's a very dear, very, very dear friend of mine. How it came about, I said to Sharon, me and Rick, we don't see each other on a regular basis, but it's kind of like I'm going through a Geneva airport or I'm going through London. I go, Rick, you know, and I run into him like kind of like that, you know. But there's no frills. I mean, he's a phenomenal guy and he's a phenomenal player. And I wanted him on my album, and I got him on my album, and I get what I want, you know.
Voices, a thousand voices, whispering, the time has passed for choices, golden days are passing. We'll be right back.
I mean, when I came back out, I thought, man, have they forgotten me? Is it all over? Have they moved on to this new shit that's going around now, you know, whatever? And here I am again, man, you know. I mean, I've seen them all come, and I've seen... I mean, when I was in the 80s, when it was like the Motley Crue, the Def Leppards, the Poisons and all that whirlwind, I mean, stuck in the middle of that, like, and I'm thinking, man, how am I going to survive this? Like, and they've all gone by the wayside, and I'm still carrying on, you know. Redbeard, to be totally 100% honest with you, I haven't got the foggiest idea. And do you know what? I don't want to. All I am is I'm one hell of a humble guy, man. Well, not humble. Nearly humble. I'm an asshole, really.